Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. We're discussing the Liberal Party, of course, after the federal election. Originally, Kevin Andrews suggested a discussion on this, and then we asked Maurice Payne, and then Christopher Pine mentioned he wanted to talk. So we thought the best way to handle this was to start a bit early and put everyone together. So our speakers are going to speak for about 15 minutes each. Then we'll go to questions and discussion, finished no later than 7, but probably a bit before. I'll introduce our three speakers. We'll lead off with Maurice Payne, studied arts and law at UNSW, Senator for New South Wales since 1997, had a number of committee positions and others, but currently Shadow Parliamentary Secretary for Foreign Affairs. Then we'll go with Kevin Andrews, who was at the Institute in the middle of last year. He studied arts and law at Melbourne University, MHR for Menzies since 1991, and of course his most recent governmental position was Minister for Immigration and Citizenship, and he's currently chairing the Federal State Relations Task Force for the Coalition. And finally, Christopher Pine, who studied law at the University of Adelaide, MHR for Sturt since 1993. In government, he was most recently Minister for Ageing, and he's currently Shadow Minister for Justice and Border Protection. So many thanks to the three of our speakers, and we'll lead off with Maurice Payne. Thanks.
I can't get my watch to sit still. Jared and Anne, thank you very much for the invitation to be here this evening. If the American writer Mark Twain were in this situation tonight, he may have been minded to observe that rumours of our death are greatly exaggerated. So while far from lifeless, there's no denying that the entity that is, the Liberal Party is in great need of rejuvenation. Nor is it to say that we underestimate the dimension of the challenge ahead of us in returning Liberals to government at state and federal levels. There is, however, no doubt that we continue to have great strengths on which to draw, including our history and philosophy, our experience, our demonstrated capacity for strength and leadership in government, and our people, as just some examples. The 2007 election result, a 5.4% swing against us, was a sobering one. There's a tellingly large number of new faces on the government benches, but ultimately, that means we need to take 9 seats to be in a position to regain government. That's a number we need to repeat to ourselves every minute of every day and never lose sight of the target. It's also important to acknowledge, particularly in the modern political world, the growing inevitability of the political cycle. Except in hereditary monarchies, born to rule went out of vogue a long time ago. And for a Republican like me, that's just fine. But it also applies to the democratic process. The electorate has taken to saying time with vigour. And frankly, that's unsurprising. What we should take out of this experience are the opportunity and the challenge of creating our new future and avoid wallowing in the past. The Liberal Party of Australia, over its 6-plus decades of history, has been the custodian of 2 strands of political thought, liberalism and conservatism. And it's a blend that, in its true state, has stood the test of time. The fundamentals of individual freedom, the dignity of humanity, and personal responsibility are tenets of liberal faith. So in this context, countless references have been made to the Liberal Party representing the broad church. Now, as a member of that church, I have on some occasions felt that only one side of the congregation was truly welcome at the service. I say that with no rancour, but it does impact on my perception of the future of my party and my observations here today. After what would be described as a fairly lengthy run on the part for the predominantly conservative position through the recent years of government, I suggest that the successful future of the party in this century lies in what might be described as a more representative expression of the breadth of liberal philosophy. That is, a balance of the threads of our philosophical fabric. And in doing so, we'll be drawing on perhaps our greatest strength, our strong philosophical base built by Menzies and his contemporaries through the 1940s and beyond. The challenge for the future is to re-examine and take up those core liberal values and apply them in a relevant and modern way to contemporary Australian politics. And to achieve that, we must modernise our approach within our philosophical framework, which is both imperative and doable. I'm really pleased to hear Dr. Nelson alluding to the dual philosophical strands of the Liberal Party and our Deputy Julie Bishop discussing the redevelopment of our social agenda in the important policy review process. So in looking to the future and how it might take shape, I reflect briefly on recent experience. I recall what I heard as a significant concern of many long-time Liberal voters at the last election as to why, with the economy as strong as it was, the strength of our leadership as effective as it was, they would not be voting Liberal. The answer was, often, that we lacked compassion and heart. I have just a couple of examples. For older women who'd been giving to the collection plate at their local church for decades to support the dispossessed and disadvantaged of the world, they simply didn't accept or even really understand our approach to refugees, our approach to the detention of children in particular. And ladies and gentlemen, you all know who I mean. Are you thinking about an aunt or a neighbour? She was always a Liberal voter, but also a person whose steely resolve meant that once she'd changed her mind, there was no going back. And a strongly articulated argument about our commitment to the humanitarian resettlement program didn't cut much ice with those formidable advocates. Also, a similar view from the families of Australians who believed that the life of their family member was not perceived by our government as sufficiently mainstream to merit the respect and basic human rights that the rest of the community takes for granted, just because they were gay. Given the rhetoric on occasion, it was difficult to persuade them otherwise. We were also perceived by them as lacking in basic compassion, effectively relegating certain Australians to the bench, given they apparently weren't wanted on the so-called mainstream team. Why would you vote for us if you believed that we didn't like the lives of your granddaughter and her partner, or your son, or your nephew? What happened, they asked, to freedom of the individual, to freedom of choice, to basic respect for human dignity? We can talk about the importance of family all we like, but once we're perceived as telling Australians that we don't much like some members of their family, or indeed the way their family is structured for those not falling within the traditional definition, we're crossing a line. And in my view, we pay a philosophical price for that. The cynical amongst you might observe, not unreasonably, that those raising such concerns with Maurice Payne were expecting to preach to the converted. Indeed, they may have been. But the final word was theirs. They did not vote for us. So, in 2008 and beyond, whether it's the redevelopment of our social agenda or the highlighting of our economic achievements, it's absolutely vital to recognise it is actually 2008. We need to be modern, to be dynamic and responsive, and to acknowledge and respect the inevitably changing nature of Australian life. That doesn't mean we always have to agree with it. But as a professional political organisation, we cannot afford a head-in-the-sand approach. We must tackle change, and concomitant with that, address the shift of the political priorities of many Australians. We need a modern agenda described in modern language, an agenda where the priorities, some needing reconsideration in the context of our loss, will include climate change and water issues, actually addressing why women are still paid less than men in exactly the same jobs, from the cleaner to the doctor, dealing with the reality of modern family life in its many versions, and particularly post-relationship breakdown, let alone the notorious work-life balance, and that's just for starters. The successful Liberal Party of the future will needs be a modern, diverse organisation, one that more broadly reflects the Australian community in its membership and in its parliamentary representation. Without that, we're doomed to engage with ourselves, or replicas thereof, which is not a recipe for growth and effective community engagement leading to greater electoral success. Now, rather radically, apparently, it's my view that the precondition for membership of the Liberal Party should be one's commitment to liberalism. So whether you're a committed Christian, a devout Muslim, or a blasé agnostic should be irrelevant. Frankly, in my own division of New South Wales in recent times, it seems that hasn't always been the case. So in growing, in building our diversity and capacity to represent the breadth of Australian society, it would be useful to attract more members from diverse multicultural Australia, to encourage as members more women who seek to be involved in the political process and to be leaders, and to bring to our team more young Australians who see membership of a centre-right political party as a way to express their ideas in a stimulating environment of open minds and open debate. I don't support quotas to achieve a particular level of representation of one of those groups or another. What we must have is the level of professionalism to know this engagement with the broad community is what we need and to go about rebuilding a party in which it can be achieved. Although parliaments are relatively conservative institutions, they are gradually changing to reflect a more diverse community, and the Liberal Party can't afford to be left behind in that process. Of course, inviting new and interesting people to join the party can be fraught with danger. What happens to them after they experience a first branch meeting, for example? For some, that beginning is absolutely the end. Some will want to support us, but to have minimal involvement with the organisation. Some will want active engagement and input into the development of policy in key areas. The British Conservatives have run the Stand Up, Speak Up policy development process in their renewal. It's an interesting option, and I hope it can be considered in the review of our policy development. Debate about reform of the party organisation is again underway in several places. I've seen comments by Michael Kroger, former Victorian president, about how much energy and, frankly, increasingly scarce financial resources we expend at the micro level, and I tend to agree with his observations. So identifying organisational arrangements for a modern Liberal Party, so the organisation is part of rebuilding the Liberals into an appealing proposition for future government, is a basic but important step. We'll grapple with many other challenges as we seek to modernise a 60-year-old political party and rebuild after the demise of a strong Liberal government whose electoral sin was particularly its longevity. But we have a depth of capacity and talent in our parliamentary and organisational ranks, particularly in this new generation of Liberals, that is well equipped for the task. I've said that I particularly hope that young people would join the Liberal Party to express their politics in an environment of open minds and open debate. That environment must be the way of the world in all cases in the Liberal Party, not the exception. We can't be afraid of open discussion and robust debate, and we should encourage it. That goes for our councils, even our party rooms, and the broader political debate like this evening. If we feel constrained about open expression, if there's any culture of intimidation, we are venturing into illiberal territory. And I, for one, have had enough of any suggestion that a political party is the last place to discuss policy and politics in a robust fashion. Ladies and gentlemen, politics is fundamentally about people. So for all the departments and programs, all the theories, all the spin, it's the people who matter and the people who will have the last say. Our Australian democracy, our government by the people, is a great institution with its foundations struck firmly in peace, not conflict. It's not perfect, but it's an impressive model. Of the building blocks of that democracy, viable political parties are indispensable. The Liberal Party is a fundamental of the future of the Australian democracy. And as a modern, dynamic political party, firmly enmeshed in the unforgiving political cycle, it will continue to be so.
Thanks, Senator Payne. Whilst Kevin Andrews coming up, I should say what I should have said earlier. Thanks to Barry O'Farrell, the opposition leader, for making this theatre available to us tonight. Kevin Andrews, thank you.
Thank you, Jared and Anne. Colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the opportunity of being here tonight to address what is an important topic, given that the non-Labor side of politics is not in government, either federally or in any state in Australia, and therefore we face a critical task of rebuilding. I want to address three issues tonight. First, what I believe is an overriding principle upon which we can move forward with unity. Secondly, I wish to draw a distinction between principles on the one hand and policies on the other. And thirdly, I'll state what I believe are some basic principles that I believe we should retain and move forward with. One thing is certain for a political party new in opposition. That is that every critic in the land has advice to offer. Each knows exactly what went wrong and what needs to be done to win office again. Many advocate an abandonment of the principles and policies of the past and an embrace of the so-called progressive. Let me illustrate. Writing in the Financial Review after the election, Melbourne political economist Dennis Altman said that the Liberal Party must move with the times. I quote, "The Liberals will come under pressure to demonstrate that they too are progressive on non-economic issues," he said. "The Liberals can either embrace these changes or risk becoming as irrelevant at the federal level as they appear to be at the state level." Now, the only hint of what Mr. Altman actually proposed is that we need to attract a wider range of Australians, more ethnically and ideologically diverse. However, this view overlooks the people who deserted the coalition and who need to be attracted back. The seats that Labor won in the November election were mostly in the outer suburban and regional hubs of Australia, the western suburbs of Sydney, the outer northern and southern suburbs of Adelaide and Brisbane, the Geelong region in Victoria, the New South Wales Central Coast, and so on. These were the same people who voted in the Howard government in 1996. And their issues are basic ones: to have a secure job for themselves and for their children, to educate their kids, to receive adequate health care, to live in safe surroundings, to raise their family and live peacefully in a culture which supports their values. They're the small business operators, the working class trades, men and women, the parents who care for their children and work part-time, the people who want to retire in some comfort and enjoy old age. It was to them that Mr. Rudd appealed as a fiscal conservative. If greater diversity is what is required, how did the Labor Party, with the majority of its parliamentarians drawn largely from tertiary educated trade union officials, win the election? How did the coalition, with more women selected on merit rather than a quota, lose office? The danger for parties new to opposition is to believe that they have to move away from the centre in order to win again. Australian politics, I contend, and Australian elections, I contend, are won at the centre. Mr. Rudd moved the perception of the Labor Party to the centre. Whether his policies and programs will match that rhetoric remains to be seen. The coalition, therefore, should not abandon the centre in favour of the latest trendy alternative or middle-class left fancy. That, I believe, will condemn us to opposition for many years to come. Let me turn then to my first issue, a unifying principle. In Michael Novak's 1982 seminal Apologia for Private Property, Freer Markets and Individual Agency, The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism, he confidently wrote, "Of all the systems of political economy which have shaped our history, none has so revolutionised ordinary expectations of human life, lengthened the lifespan, made the elimination of poverty and famine thinkable, enlarged the range of human choice, as democratic capitalism." Democratic capitalism is neither exclusively liberal nor conservative, neither secularist nor religious. It implies a role for constitutional government, is responsive to community standards, and rejects social engineering. For the Liberal Party of Australia, democratic capitalism is a useful term to sum up what I believe unites its members. As Liberals, we should be proud of the achievements of this nation's spirit of democratic capitalism. We should know that our mission is to represent it and to harness it and nurture it, as well as to accommodate practical forms of leadership at every level of government. Along with its role as defender of Australian capitalist democracy, the Liberal Party of Australia, as Maurice has pointed out, is the custodian of two great intellectual as well as political traditions, liberalism and conservatism. By liberalism, I mean classical liberalism, not libertarianism, which poses as liberalism. And by conservatism, I do not mean reactionary politics that seek to impose social order at the expense of basic rights. Conservatives believe the social order is organic and evolving, in which capitalist modes of exchange is an integral part. Liberals believe in the primacy of individuals exchanging ideas and goods and services that drive progress. Both liberals and conservatives believe in the role of the rule of law, in constitutionalism, property rights and economic freedom, the primacy of the family and other civic institutions. There are differences in how to protect these ideals, but the creative tension between the liberal and the conservative, I believe, typically produces a policy development and platform that best reflects the majority of Australians. If the Liberal Party is to remain relevant, it must acknowledge with a great deal of confidence that the race it continues to run has been and is honourable. Let me illustrate. The Liberal Party is the party of migration. While it's all very well for the Labor Party to look teary-eyed at the legacy of Chifley and Corbell, the Light on the Hill Party, while in government, deported 9,000 Asian brides of veterans, a decision which Menzies reversed. We should remind ourselves that the greatest expansion of migration occurred under Liberal governments, and it was a Liberal government that dismantled, albeit progressively, the White Australia policy. While Gough Whitlam introduced the Racial Discrimination Act, his government showed no enthusiasm for migration by reducing migrant numbers to a post-war low and ignored the plight of refugees from Indochina. The Howard government continued the tradition of Menzies with the second highest or second largest migrant intake of any post-war government and one of the world's most generous humanitarian programs. Furthermore, it saved the national migration program from a massive lack of public confidence by emphasising more business and skilled migration, the importance of integration and citizenship, and greater border control against illegal entrance and poaching. Well, let me take another example. The Liberal Party is the party of Indigenous affairs. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders were given the franchise in 1964. A non-discriminatory constitutional reform was achieved in 1967. Land reform for the Northern Territory was legislated in 1976. In the spirit of bipartisanship, we supported ATSIC in the early 90s. And when Mark Lotham broke that with that, we embarked on a new era of Indigenous affairs, which the new Labor government appears to be supporting, if you like, applying the spirit of democratic capitalism to Indigenous affairs. Let me turn then to the future. So I said I wish to draw a distinction between principles and policies. By principles, I mean the fundamental concepts that govern our approach to a range of issues, be they economic, social, or cultural. By policies, I refer to specific actions that we would take as a government in the future. It is my contention that it is important that we clearly set out our principles as an alternate government. A party need not have a policy about every issue likely to confront it when in office. When John Howard was elected in 1996, it was often claimed that he came to office without many detailed policies. But what he did bring was a clear set of principles that he had articulated over many years and were understood by Australians. These included a commitment to good financial management, a flexible, responsive economy, support for the family and vibrant businesses to create jobs, a secure, peaceful country, and a people at ease with their own national identity. Mr Rudd won the last election on essentially two platforms. With one or two notable exceptions, he would implement the then government's policies, and secondly, he'd be a fiscal conservative. Now, in each case, there were other policies, but I suggest that most people voted on the perceptions they had formed about the respective political leaders, both in 1996 and again in 2007. This is not to say that opposition parties should not develop and articulate policies in a range of areas. The tragedy of state oppositions throughout Australia over the past few years has been, in my view, their inability to develop, or if they have developed them, to articulate their policies. People vote on their perceptions and not generally on issues, but it is in response to the various issues that go to create the important perceptions, and that's why hard policy work remains important. I said earlier that the aspirations and dreams of the great majority of Australians are reasonably clear. To be able to determine their own future, to have a suitable job, to live in modest comfort in a peaceful and secure environment, to raise a family, to hand on to their children a good education and reasonable prospects for a dignified life, to have access to adequate health care, to be part of a culture which is supportive of their beliefs and outlooks, to sustain the economy and the environment of their nation, and to retire, to enjoy old age, and as necessary, to have access to appropriate care. We don't expect these things for nothing. We understand the responsibility to work, to care for others, to be tolerant, and to help to provide for the common good. We know that government cannot do all, and that no other nation owes Australia a living. What flows from this knowledge is a set of principles that should shape our response to the issues of the future. The first, I believe, is freedom, economic and political. While the left talk incessantly about political freedom, while often seeking to deny a voice of those with different ideas, as we've witnessed since the election in some quarters, the reality is that the loss of economic freedom inevitably leads to a loss of political freedom. One of the first acts of the Rudd government was to wind back the economic freedom of the individual in the labour market. Under the guise of adjusting the safety net, Labour seeks to remove entirely the ability of a person to enter into a statutory protected individual agreement with his or her employer. Let me be clear. Sensible policy adjustment is always necessary, whether in government or opposition. There will be some positions that the new opposition will take that must necessarily be different from those of the old government. It will, however, be a fundamental mistake and do enduring damage to our cause if we holus-bolus walk away from what we have stood for over the years. The principle of economic freedom is not a recent invention. The second principle of democratic freedom also leads to certain conclusions. One is that the people of Australia should be governed by their elected representatives, not unelected officials. Hence, a Bill of Rights which replaces the will of the people with abstract concepts as interpreted by an unelected judiciary should, in my opinion, be resisted. Thirdly, we can recognise the reality that freedom cannot survive unless it is based on moral foundations. Responsibility walks hand in hand with freedom. Hence, the encouragement of self-reliance rather than reliance upon the welfare state. Support for the central place of functional families for the upbringing of children, fostering the role of community organisations rather than government bureaucracy, the encouragement to belong to one nation rather than a series of segregated groups, and the recognition that the hand of government should be the second resort, not the first, are principles that underpin a party of democratic capitalism. I personally long believed that three things are important for our national future: functional families to give our children the best start in life, caring and responsive communities, and vibrant businesses. These, of course, must be built on a foundation of economic and national security and a shared identity. These are bases upon which we can move forward in reviewing our specific policies, work which we formally commence today in the Coalition Policy Review Committee, of which Maurice and I are both members. In the coming months, I hope that we can continue to outline this approach in more detail as we undertake the important and critical task of rebuilding for the future.
Thank you, Jared, for the opportunity to be here tonight to present to the Sydney Institute and ladies and gentlemen. Does anyone still doubt the need to modernise the Liberal Party of Australia? Out of office in every state, territory and the Commonwealth, our membership base is at an all-time low. We've been out-campaigned and out-fundraised by our rival for public office. In 1996, in every state, territory and the Commonwealth, the Liberal Party held 256 lower house seats. In 2008, we hold 155. In 12 years, our firepower has diminished by 40%. We've lost the last 22 state and territory elections. And just when you thought it couldn't get any worse, I have to tell you it can. While it's true that the last five times the government changed in Australia at the subsequent election, there was a swing against the new government, that has not been the pattern at the state and territory level since 1999. At the federal level, in 1951, the opposition gained 0.3% at the election of that year. In 1974, 1%. In 1977, 1.1%. In 1984, 1.5%. And in 1998, 4.6%. I'll be expending every energy to ensure this pattern is repeated and that we break the cycle and win the next federal election, and I fervently believe that we can. But we would be naive to assume that business as usual will deliver that victory. Since 1999, state and territory oppositions have found that their perceived shortcomings have led to a second dose of the public's medicine in six cases: New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, South Australia, the Northern Territory and Tasmania, and virtually no change in two, Western Australia and the ACT. The party is perilously close to the edge of the waterfall. But we can do something about it. We can modernise every facet of our party, other than our reason for existence, which has never changed, to avoid going over. The federal opposition led by Brendan Nelson is showing that we are not broken or bowed. We are taking the fight to Labor in Canberra. We are confounding the critics and naysayers. But Brendan Nelson can't bear responsibility for the counter-offensive on his own. The Liberal Party itself must change. There is tremendous scope for fresh ideas, for new thinking, for being prepared to use 2008 as a year of modernisation of our organisation. It would be a tragedy to waste this opportunity. Tonight, I'd like to highlight where I believe change will bring about electoral success and allow the Liberal Party to govern for the better throughout the country in the future. My party needs to embrace a change that will replenish our membership. A strong membership is a strong resource for developing policy, in campaigning, in fundraising, in spreading the word, in providing the candidates, staff and personnel that every political party needs. I believe the Liberal Party should implement a practice that has been initiated by right-of-centre political parties around the world to their benefit, allowing all party members to select the parliamentary leader. With one stroke, we would give Australians a reason to join and become active in the party. As Michael Kroger pointed out in his column in The Australian on February 18, the coalition parties need to do the same amount of work they did 50 years ago with 25% of the resources. The influx of new members that would accompany empowering the grassroots membership in this way would revitalise the membership of the party, bringing us new ideas, destroying rotten boroughs, creating a phalanx of new campaign workers, fundraisers and potential candidates. For many, this will seem like a radical idea, but it's not too radical for the practice to be the case in the UK Conservative Party, the French Union for a Popular Movement, the Canadian Conservative Party, or even the Likud in Israel. The Republican Party and the Democrats in the US have raised grassroots participation to unprecedented heights. Barry Cohen, writing about the US primary system in The Australian on February 14th, wrote, "A long time ago, Americans realised that no system was truly democratic unless voters not only elected their president and congressman, but also participated in choosing the different parties' candidates. No system of democracy is perfect, but the primary process is one that Australia should at least be considering. I would envisage that the Liberal Party adopt a similar model to our sister party in the UK. In essence, the Conservative Party in the UK allows the parliamentary party to choose the candidates that will be offered to the membership from amongst their number. The broader membership of the party then chooses between the two candidates who emerged from the parliamentary party ballot. Leadership ballots are only held when a spill of the leadership is initiated and carried by the parliamentary party, or when the leader resigns or retires. A person whose leadership is overturned in a spill cannot nominate as a candidate for leader in the subsequent ballot. And critically, the membership itself cannot spill the party's leadership. Such a model would ensure there is no possibility of seeing a repeat of the shambles that was the process adopted by the Australian Democrats. The UK model ensures that the parliamentary party puts forward two candidates who they believe have the capacity to lead the party to victory, fulfil the role of Prime Minister, and have a largely united party behind them. But it also means that the candidate who is selected by the Conservative Party members has shown their appeal to a wider audience than the few hundred members of the parliamentary party. To win, they would likely have demonstrated their ability to conquer the media, to articulate a message, and to have an agenda that the wider audience wishes to support. David Cameron's modern campaign to win the Conservative Party leadership in October 2005 through the internet, television, radio and public appearances across the UK generated a following both within the party and amongst the general public that gave him a springboard, once successful, to portray his party as having a newness that it had lacked since the defeat of John Major's government in May 1997. This was obvious in the polls, the reaction to David Cameron by Tony Blair, and by the increase in interest in the Conservative Party after years of seeming listlessness following the almost two decades of rule. There can be little argument that in the US, where the Republicans have involved their membership in this way since the middle of the 19th century, the Republican Party itself is a healthier specimen because of it. And this is the case too for the Likud in Israel. In 1993, the Likud held their first membership-wide election for their candidate for Prime Minister. This was repeated in 1999. Both times, the candidates the Likud chose went on to win elections for their party. And more than that, the consequent media attention lifted the profile of the Likud and demonstrated that the party was vibrant and open. And finally, in Canada, I'll quote you one brief statistic. In 2006, 144,289 Alberta Progressive Conservative Party members turned out to vote at polling booths in their leadership election in 2006. Alberta has a population of 3.4 million people. If the same proportion was to be repeated just in South Australia, it would be the equivalent of the South Australian Liberal Party having 60,000 members. Imagine how such a number would transform politics in my state. If our sister right-of-centre parties around the world have been able to manage this, I can't think of why a sophisticated political party such as the Liberal Party can't conceive of such a change. The Australian public are more actively interested in politics today than at any time in our nation's history. They have more ways to be involved. The internet has transformed politics. The interaction between people through Facebook, email, YouTube and all the other methods of sharing and accessing information mean that people want to be more involved and they expect to be given a real role. If we need any more evidence of our need to embrace grassroots democracy, we need look no further than the phenomenal success of GetUp. While the centre-right of politics might not agree with their policy positions, they have proven there is a new way. They've used the internet to create a political movement in which every registered person feels they have a real say in the direction that organisation is headed and what they do. And just in case you do wish to look further than the success of GetUp, I'll give you another insight into where voters are getting their information from. There are 1.8 million members of the Australian network on Facebook. The vast majority would be voters. The Australian network, which wouldn't include all Australians, as plenty of Facebook users don't join a network, equates to 14% of the people who voted on November 24 last year. And that number will only grow. Voters today want to be involved, to be taken seriously. With all the choices they can make, they are not going to be part of an organisation that takes from them and gives little in return. Allowing our members a real say in selecting the person who leads the party and represents the party in Parliament will give people a reason to join the Liberal Party. We need to add to our membership, to build on what we have, to give those in the party now the support they need. There's another area I want to touch on tonight. An idea to end the winner-takes-all outcomes in organisational elections that sap our energies and strength because of the disappointment they inevitably stoke and the disunity they engender. Almost all the internal elections that occur across the Liberal Party at the moment are preferential or first past the post. We need to move to a system of voting that ensures all modes of thought in our broad church are genuinely represented, that they all have a place at the table. The method of voting that will bring about this outcome is proportional representation. Currently, if a group of like-minded individuals can garner enough support at a party conference or annual general meeting, they can generally win all the positions, or as close to it, as are available. This leads inevitably to any other group of like-minded individuals being shut out of the political process. When politically active and interested people are denied a voice in their own party, they have few options available to them to influence events. And we've seen the result of this across every state division of the party: leaking, undermining, the traducing of reputation and disunity. The winners from this have been the Labor Party. How can we expect to win when, rather than focusing on building an agenda, campaigning, fundraising, or finding and training the best candidates for seats, we are instead focused internally? To break out of this frustrating loop, we have to find a way to cut the Gordian knot. The answer is proportional representation. This is a system of voting similar to the system used to elect most upper houses in Australia. Where there's more than one candidate to be elected to a position, a quota is established and preferences distributed until each successful candidate reaches the quota. Of course, it would not be able to be used in every situation. There can only be one president. But for vice presidents and executives, upper house tickets and in other ways, proportional representation would ensure that everyone in the Liberal Party had a fair chance to have their opinion represented in the party forums. There were some who will argue this conceives of factions existing in the Liberal Party. Tom Playford, our 28-year Premier of South Australia in the 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s, once said, "In politics, you have different friends on different days for different reasons." In the Liberal Party, factions will never take serious hold, as they have in the Labor Party. When it comes to issues, we Liberals are too individualistic to be told how to think by our peers. The alliances that form and reform in the Liberal Party have porous boundaries. Take me as a case in point. I believe, as Robert Menzies did, that the state's role is more than as a mere keeper of the ring. Yet I'm an advocate of a small footprint for government and low taxes, recognising that the individual is better placed than the state to decide on what they wish to spend their hard-earned resources. I believe in social justice and abhor discrimination. When presented with choices that are loosely termed life issues, my voting record on euthanasia, RU486, embryonic stem cell research and cloning would place me as a conservative. Yet I'm a Republican. The media and much of the Liberal Party characterise me a moderate. I'm a classic example of why formal factions will never take root in the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party has always, since our founding, embraced what some call institutionalised diversity of opinion. There exists in every party division guaranteed representation for young people, for women, and for people outside the major capital cities. our party founders, to varying degrees, recognised that to be a broadly based party, we had to build on special rules that gave Young Liberals genuine representation on state executives and state councils. The party in South Australia has a rural council and women's council with delegates to the governing bodies of the party. Our constitution requires, wherever there are two or more delegates to be elected from party bodies, that at least one be a man and one be a woman. So proportional representation would sit well with the structure we've had in place in the party since 1944. Far from institutionalising factions, it would ensure that the need to congregate around groups of like-minded individuals would be less important. It would also mean that the party would be better served by the best and brightest of all our available personnel, rather than those who in the current winner-takes-all atmosphere have prevailed. The Liberal Party's new federal president, Alan Stockdale, said in an interview with The Australian, "We need to provide better incentives to new members, and the more diverse their backgrounds, the better. We need to recast the party's constitutional structure so we broaden our base and bring more people into the party and draw on the community's resources." In two sentences, he's encapsulated the message of my speech today. What better way to provide set incentives to new members and draw on the community's resources than to engage them in the political process? We need to show the public that we value their opinions, that we aren't preaching to them, that we are instead responding to them, providing for their involvement in a meaningful way by giving party members a vote for the party's leadership would harness their skills and energy in a way that we are not doing as well as we should now. To attract new members and keep those we have, we need to present them with a party where every member is expending their energy on constructive pursuits, policy development, fundraising, campaigning and supporting candidates. The introduction of proportional representation in internal party elections will help bring that about. These two reforms would transform the Liberal Party of Australia, placing us again in the first rank of centre-right parties around the world, and give us the foundation to begin the journey back to government around the country. Thank you.
Yes, I'll get all three speakers up. We don't have a chair, so I think if we just all stand around here, we've got about half an hour for questions and discussion. I should say that both Maurice Payne and Christopher Pine previously addressed the Sydney Institute along with Kevin Andrews, so it's great to have them all back. And thanks to our speakers for all keeping very strictly to the time. It's amazing. We've got three politicians and all of them went for exactly 15 minutes. It's terrific. So, okay, so we'll start. I just ask you to address your questions or your comments to a speaker and then the speaker can come up to the microphone. So let's start. Can I just ask you, Christopher, about your proposal? Second time around, the British Conservatives elected David Cameron. First time around, Ian Duncan Smith. Mm-hmm. That doesn't look too good now. How do you see it working out in practice?
I think the example in the UK, Jared, is a good example of how it would work in practice. The UK Conservatives provide a bit of a model of what not to do in the first instance and what to do in the second. And they learnt from that mistake. In the first instance, they elected Ian Duncan Smith, who I'm sure was a very worthy fellow. He'd never been a minister in either the Major or Thatcher governments. And he was chosen largely because the Parliamentary Party chose the person who represented the anti-European stand, and he was a factional choice. That was a monumental failure. And the second time around, when they had a chance to do something different with David Cameron, they actually took it much more seriously and elected a person who they thought would carry them into government. Now, what I hope to achieve by raising this issue so early in this term and having it debated within the Liberal Party and more generally is to not make the same mistakes that the Conservative Party made, but actually learn from them. They also introduced a cap on spending that candidates could spend so that there'd be no accusations that a high-wealth individual would be able to win the election by simply pouring resources at the campaign. I think that was also a sensible measure. And between times, they introduced a change so that a leader who was deposed in a spill, for example, couldn't then seek election by the party membership. because I think that would probably have resulted in those leaders being re-elected, because the membership tend to be very supportive of whoever the leader is at a particular time. So I think that the way the UK Conservative has developed is a much better, is a good model, and the Liberal Party would learn from those mistakes that they made early in the piece.
Thanks. And there's a question there that come across here, up the back.
My question is to Christopher. In the South Australian Liberal Party, you adopted plebiscites in local seats for pre-selections for lower house members. Can you perhaps give us a snapshot of how that works, how it has worked? Is that a model that you think should be followed by all divisions across the country?
As Mary said, it must work well because they chose me instead. Actually, I was chosen by a college under the very old system. I've been around so long that I'm unfortunately in the old superannuation scheme and the old pre-selection college system. It's good in one case. But more seriously, the plebiscite system was introduced in South Australia to stem the issue that I talked about in my speech, which was the feeling that party members didn't get anything very much for their membership. The plebiscites have only operated so far in the state election last time around and in grey for the last federal election because Barry Wakeland was a retiring member. In that case, it worked very well. Of about 600 eligible people, about 400 travelled, turned up, and grey is 94% of South Australia's mass. And they travelled from right across grey to one town and voted, 400 people out of 600. So I thought that was a very good indication of people taking that process very seriously, and they chose a good member. Of course, voting for the party leadership is really just an extension of the plebiscite system. If you support plebiscites and think that the party membership are capable enough of choosing the candidate for a particular seat, then it's hard to mount an argument against the party membership not being capable enough of making pragmatic and sensible decisions about who should be party leader. And so I see the proposal of the of what's happened in Canada, the UK, France and even Israel as simply an extension of what we've done in South Australia.
Now, I know that Maurice or Kevin want to make, if you want to make any comments, so let me know. There's a question over the back there. Yeah.
Hello, Andrew Higgs. My question is for Christopher Pine in respect to the proportional voting system that you proposed for the election of state executive. How would you propose that the proposal go forward, and when would you suggest we do that? And in which state would you suggest we put forward as a guinea pig?
Well, of course, the great state of South Australia has always led on these great reform issues over the last 100 and so years. We're the first state to let women vote and the first state to let women stand for parliament, etc. There's a long list of firsts. So I can tell you that South Australia is already, in the Liberal Party, moving towards a reform of our entire structure. Our President, Sean Edwards, has initiated the meetings of state presidents around Australia. And Martin Hamilton Smith, our state leader, initiated the meeting of state leaders. And we've already begun under the a chairmanship or a group which includes Sean Edwards, Martin Hamilton Smith, Corey Bernardi and Simon Birmingham, a drafting committee, as small as we could possibly find, in order to bring forward reform proposals at the August meeting of our state council. Given the state of the Liberal Party around the country, I would be very surprised if South Australia didn't reform its constitution this year. And one of the proposals that is front and centre in this reform will be proportional representation.
A question to Kevin, and possibly Maurice may like to comment too. You mentioned, I found startling statistics about how Labor is in fact anti-immigration in many areas of its history. And to me, the tragedy of the Liberal Party is that the Labor Party has hijacked this notion that they are the party of tolerance and open doors and all the rest, when in fact, in many cases, as you rightly point out, they've been no different from Conservative governments or Liberal governments in attitudes to immigration. How does the Liberal Party capture the sort of ideas debate, which I think has been let go terribly badly in 50 years in the Liberal Party, to make it clear that the party stands for something that is mainstream, tolerant, whatever? And to what extent is this being made worse by the last government's unfortunate tendency to get tagged with an intolerant and non-small-L liberal image.
Thanks, Anne. There aren't too many advantages of being in opposition, but there is one, and that is it gives you a time to reflect and to look at your policies again, to look at what are the core principles that you believe in, and to re-examine the policies in the light of those core principles and therefore look at how you can go forward. And it seems to me that, as I illustrated, if you look at the 50 years or so, 60 years of the Liberal Party, there are some areas in which we have been at the forefront. Immigration is one of those, Indigenous affairs is another. We could name a whole lot of examples. So I think it's a matter of stepping back from where we've been to ask ourselves, and we're discussing this in the Policy Review Committee this morning, what are the challenges that will face Australia in the next 5, 10, 15 years? And for us to start to articulate what those challenges are and to start to argue and advocate for a way in which we can address those challenges. And I think through that process, then we get back to the fundamentals of what we believe in and can articulate that. I think it's also a product of a number have spoken about longevity in government. I think the longer you're in government, and I'm speaking now as someone who was a minister for 6 years, the longer you're in government, the more you get tied up with the day-to-day activity within your particular portfolio or with the government generally if you're the Prime Minister. And I think there is, as I think Maurice said in her comments, there is a it's time factor, if you like, so far as the populace is concerned. And I think part of that is that you become more and more embroiled in the detail of the administration of particular portfolios and government, and therefore perhaps don't stand back and articulate those broader principles that we fundamentally believe in.
Two things, actually. On the question of party reform and some of the issues that Christopher has been raising, of course, for those who are interested in the activities of the New South Wales division, both the arcane and otherwise, the party president is valiantly advancing reform discussions in the New South Wales division, has been holding public fora and endeavouring to engage the organisation in that process. And one of the considerations in that discussion is the question of proportional representation and restructuring in that regard. So, and I think that's very important. In response to Anne's question, what I would absolutely say is that I think politics in Australia is stultifyingly dull because we don't seem, it seems to me, particularly welcome open discourse and debate. I mean, debate is characterised by the media as dissent and division, and that is a bad thing. And so people who find themselves in leadership being told they're dealing with dissent and division run a million miles from that and say, everyone be quiet, everyone shut down, we'll have a very quiet, confidential discussion, which of course then leads to quite comprehensive leaking in some cases from cabinet and ministry meetings. And that's a byproduct of not being prepared to be sufficiently robust, in my view, in your political beliefs and your own political capacity to actually be prepared to hold the discussion more broadly. Obviously, there are things you need to discuss privately and confidentially, obviously. But for us, the Liberal Party in Australia in 2008, we are in, ironically, the best position to advance our discussion and to advance our debate in a really healthy, public, cathartic way. And it can't be a bad thing in a political organisation. Otherwise, my dictionary definition of politics is way off, and I don't think it is. So I would say to recapture the ground, to recapture the message and the identity, which is rightfully ours, we have to be prepared to stand up at the front of the stage and talk about it. And if you're not prepared to do that, then you probably don't deserve to be a professional political organisation.
Andrew Robinson. And the question for all three members of our panel. Oh, we've heard about the broad church. Could you perhaps give us your views on whether there should be one Conservative Party throughout Australia, as has the Labour Party?
I'm happy to go. First, I think it's time to have one non-Labour Party in Australia. I say that for very practical reasons. The divisions, it seems to me, between the Liberal Party and the National Party are not that great. There are some, but there also is, Krista illustrated, divisions within the Liberal Party, which in some areas can be as great as the divisions between the Liberal Party and the National Party. Secondly, and this is just a pragmatic consideration, the reality is that if you take a trend line over time, the National Party representation in Australia has been falling for a variety of reasons, and I'm not laying any blame, I'm just trying to make a what I think is a historically accurate observation. There comes a point, therefore, where I think that we need to join forces because we are largely, you know, with differences in a broad church and that sort of expression, but largely there are many more things that we actually agree about than disagree about. So I think if we could find a way to move forward, then that would be desirable.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Andrew, I think you should declare a family interest in that question. I, in fact, am not particularly popular in this regard in parts of my own party. I don't support the leader. Thank you for that.
Sorry, just trying to help you.
As ever, I don't support a merger between between our two parties at this point in time. I've always been a strong advocate of the Liberal Party representing all of New South Wales in its own right. I have, as I was relating to someone just yesterday, sat at the opposite end of a state executive table in the face of my then current employer, John Fay, and a former employer, John Hewson, and voted against both of them on whether the Liberal Party should stand in seats like Parks and Riverina in the past. I've always believed that we should offer all of New South Wales a choice between the political parties, and I maintain that view.
Well, thank you for the question. I don't support a merger with the National Party for two reasons. One, I think most practically, if a merger did occur and the Liberals and Nationals formed one party, there's an inevitability about a country party springing up on the other side of the new merged force. Because there are particularly country independents who would coalesce around someone like Tony Windsor or Bob Katter. And there are issues and people in rural areas who believe very fervently that the Liberal Party, which is most prevalent in the cities, doesn't represent their views. So on a practical basis, the argument against merger, which I think is very compelling, is that there is an inevitability about a third party arising anyway. But for a philosophical reason too, I'm against it. Much as I like the National Party, and I have strong friends in the National Party, and I think that they play a very important role in politics, they don't actually make any pretense about representing both the Liberal and Conservative strains of political thought in Australia. The Liberal Party does. Whether it makes a pretense or whether it genuinely does, Maurice Payne and I might have a different view, judging by her speech. But nevertheless, we do have a tradition of representing both Liberal and Conservative strains of philosophical thought. The National Party doesn't, and it doesn't pretend to. So they aren't the same party. So those people who argue for a merger are ignoring a fundamental fact, which is that we are not the same as the National Party. So I would not support a merger because I don't think that we would be merging apples with apples.
Question over there. Yeah. And then here.
As a young, this is to Audrey.
Oh, I don't know. I think let's have it to someone because otherwise we'll.
Okay, Maurice.
Okay.
As a young person, They don't seem to be attracted to the Liberal Party. They don't think that their views are being taken on board by the Liberal Party. So what would you suggest the party do to get more young people on side and get young people to vote Liberal?
I think some of the remarks that I made in my speech, for example, about how we go about modernising our own agenda and modernising our language and the approach that we take to what we do on a daily basis as a political organisation is in fact a good start. I was interested in one of the Insiders programmes before the election was held last year that they actually, in the community discussion, for want of a better turn of phrase, had three or four young people who were students, one of whom was avowedly declaring his support for the Liberal Party and for the Prime Minister in the face of great adversity, I must say, from the other two who were being interviewed at the time. I was very proud of him, tried to track him down, but that didn't work, because we need those people in our branches. That sort of belief is a very good start, and we should be in a position where we can foster that and where we have individuals within our political organisations who can communicate at that level. It's been It's been some small time since I was involved in the Young Liberal movement, and if there's anyone in the room who does the maths, they're dead. But
small time.
But on that point, part of the function of those organisations is quite specific, to attract young people to the organisation. So if that's not working at that level, then we need to examine their operations as well.
I wouldn't write yourself out. I think Michael Hodgman was involved in the Young Liberal movement at the age of 74.
But there's a level of appropriateness there, Jared, and I'm just not going down that path.
Don't tell him I said that.
Tell him I said that.
That's very unkind.
Yeah.
Thank you. Marie,
Elizabeth Carpenter
is my name. Marie,
Elizabeth.
Thank you for the in New South Wales, we don't have at this stage a home of our own. At this time, could you see us reaching our grassroots and attaining our grassroots democracy, as mentioned by Chris, and appealing to those people, as mentioned by Kevin, that we could move our home up to, say, the western suburbs of Parramatta and work from there as a head office here in New South Wales?
I think you'd find that Parramatta CBD rents are in excess of Sydney CBD rents in some areas, which has always been interesting for me as someone based in Parramatta, in fact, and Debbie Murphy will, I'm sure, agree with that. Elizabeth, whether we need a home of our own per se, I mean, we have a secretariat, it's located in William Street in Woolloomooloo. One of the reasons that we chose that, and I've been, again, a member of executives when those decisions have been made over the years, was because it's functionally very close to state parliament and to a core of our parliamentary team, and that's important for our organisation and the relationship between those two. And it is a state secretariat, after all, so that is an important part of that. I don't think our first order problem is the real estate. My view, and I guess what I was trying to convey, is that our first order problem is where we find ourselves in 2008. And if we deal with those sorts of issues and the sorts of issues that Christopher and Kevin have both raised in different ways, then perhaps you come to real estate and its location a little down the line. I must say, if I was to put my cynical hat on, and there's some other people in the room who've spent a great deal of their lives working in Parramatta, the New South Wales Liberal Party would do well to look harder and further and more often to the west of Sydney in terms of extending its reach, in terms of trying to attract members, for example, from electorates who are sick of being represented by ALP dynasties decade in, decade out, and really want to do something about being completely taken for granted. And recent events of Labor politics in New South Wales, just the basis of probability would suggest to you they're not confined to Wollongong, if I might put it like that. So actually taking some steps to look further. I've always said, for example, my opposition to the construction of a second airport at Badgerys Creek as a very basic issue is because, A, it's too late. B, they should not have allowed a city to grow up around the area in which they wanted to build an airport. But secondly, politically for us, it's possibly the most stupid suggestion that anyone ever came up with, whether they're in the Department of Transport or somewhere else. If the Liberal Party is going to grow its representation in New South Wales, it has to grow it west. It has to. I'm not particularly numerate, but even I can count those seats. And so those sorts of arguments we need to be putting very strongly, and I've been trying to do that based out of Parramatta for the last decade or so, sometimes falling on more receptive ears than others.
Kevin Andrews, any view with the Victorian Liberal Party should move out to, say, Fountain Lakes?
Well, we might get a spot on Kath and Kim.
Nothing wrong with popular culture.
A question up there, yeah, Lisa.
Lisa Siegel, my question is to Kevin. Do you think that we must keep in mind that the Liberal Party was in power for 10 years, so for all those years people thought they had the right agenda. Suddenly people are saying they don't have the right agenda. Do you think that the Liberal social issues threat to the Liberal Party is over-exaggerated and maybe the population just wanted a change? Something as simple as that.
Look, I think there are as many reasons that there was a change of government as there are voters. You know, people make up their own minds in the privacy of the polling booth for a variety of reasons. And it's easy for the pundits to come along later and say it was this issue and that issue and some other issue. Obviously, you know, there is a range of issues involved. But as I said, it's sensible for us to review our policies. Not every policy that we had in government is necessarily the policy that we will take forward in opposition. And that's why I think it's important to draw a distinction between what are the basic principles which we subscribe to as a party versus the policies which are the ways in which you would bring about action in a particular area based on those principles. You know, we don't need to have a policy about every potential issue that could face us in a future government. People are not going to be worried about whether you've got 1,001 policies. They need to know you've got some policies, that they're relevant, that they've been reviewed, but in the end they're going to make a decision based on a broader perception. And that broader perception is, in a sense, what you stand for. And I think that's what's important. Now, obviously, the policies go to creating that broader perception of what you stand for, so there has to be a balance in the way in which we do this as we move forward.
Andrew. My question's to Kevin Andrews. That answer confuses me a bit, because I just came back from overseas and I've seen the polling with Kevin Rudd's party now, I think at 65%, and our party at 35%. And I asked a few people what had happened since I went away, you know, 6 weeks ago, and he said sorry to the Aboriginals, and he's done some stuff on Kyoto, and I think he's abolished work choices and a few things. So how can you say that it's just a number of individual voters making up their minds? I'm sure what's going on here is that the voters have liked Kevin Rudd's policies on these issues, things that we would not do in government, as you well know.
What did Kevin Rudd say prior to the election?
Well, hang on. Don't ask him questions.
Sorry, Greg. It was a rhetorical question. In fact, if I was Mr. Rudd, I would say that if the question you're asking me is this, but I won't. What he said prior to the election is that, with one or two exceptions, those exceptions being I'll ratify Kyoto and that I will abolish work choices, I will adopt holus bolus. And the apology, yes, three, they were basically it. I will adopt holus bolus, including tax cuts, the then government's policies. First thing he said. The second thing he said, which was by way of assurance, that I'm a fiscal conservative, which I think, you know, the jury's out on that, but anyway, that's what he said. So he didn't come forward with a whole range of detailed policies. In fact, he adopted largely our policies with a few exceptions. Now, what I'm saying is, yes, there was a change of government. People liked him. They were, I think, attracted to him as somebody they could trust, whereas they weren't prepared to vote for Kim Beazley. I think they kind of liked Kim but didn't want to make him Prime Minister. They thought Mark Latham, I won't have to say anything more. They found someone in a leader of the Labor Party that they thought that they could trust. Now, that was one element. The other elements were obviously that we'd been there for a long period of time. There were then elements in relation to individual things. But as for who, for whom work choices was an issue, or Kyoto was an issue, or an Aboriginal policy was an issue, or refugees was an issue, or whatever there was, there's a huge myriad of issues out there. In the end, I think people decided that we'd been there for quite a while. I think they thought we were getting a bit old and tired. At the same time, they thought that in Mr. Rudd there was somebody that they could trust, and they're prepared to take a punt on that.
Yes. My question's to Kevin Andrews. Kevin, a lot of what you said, I was attracted and impressed by, but one issue you raised, and it was a cordial theme, struck a chord with me, a disconnect, quite frankly. I mean, you argued that the Liberal Party, like the Labor Party, is very much in the centre. You said that we're in the centre. It's not my perception of the Howard government, or I would suggest the electorate's perception of the Howard government, that it was at the centre. It was essentially viewed as a right-wing government, a strong right-wing government that won elections because it was a strong right-wing government, but then finally lost one because it was a strong right-wing government. So I'm just wondering how you perceive the Liberal Party, how you can justify your comment that it was considered to be at the centre?
Well, I think we were and remain a centre-right party. And my argument is that one has to remain around the centre, otherwise you're going to alienate many voters. I think the thing that Mr Rudd did was he moved the Labor Party, or at least the perception of the Labor Party, from being seen as a more extreme, if I can put it that way, left-wing party, back to a centre-left party. And my argument is, in this context, is that we've got to remember that ultimately Australians are going to vote around issues around the centre, things which go to touch their own lives. It's going to be about their jobs, their security, their neighbourhood in which they live in, the education of their kids, whether there's adequate hospitals and healthcare services, whether you can get your mother or father into an aged care home, etc., etc. Those list of things which I identified in my speeches, which I think are the sort of basic issues that Australians are concerned about. Now, Mr Rudd, I think, was able to move the perception of the Labor Party back to a party which was concerned about those issues rather than some of the more fanciful things which some in the left of the Labor Party might like to implement.
Christopher Pine or Maurice?
Thanks, Jared. Just if I can comment on both Andrew and Michael's questions, but also on Kevin's answer, and of course this isn't said with any personal rancour at all, but I think one of the theses that have been produced tonight is that we need to connect with people on the issues of their daily lives. I'd put it to you that with low interest rates relatively, with low inflation, with very low unemployment, with no government debt, with a government surplus, with a future fund that other countries would die for, with a burgeoning economy for the last 11 years, unheralded in Australia's history, we'd actually covered those issues. That, in fact, far from disconnecting with the things that people cared about in terms of their daily lives, we'd covered that. And people thought we were a very good government economically. And the facts are they then looked for other issues of importance to them. And issues like climate change, like reconciliation, Kyoto and the environment generally, like work choices and the fact that they didn't feel that they were in a strong bargaining position to go out and bargain with their employers, or more importantly, that grandparents didn't think their grandchildren were in a strong bargaining position to do so, were the key issues in the election. And in my own electorate, I have suffered a percentage or two drop in every election since 1998, and including 1998, in the area that I would regard as the very safe Liberal part of my electorate, where in 1998 I received 75% of the two-party preferred vote. And this isn't one booth, this is the 16 booths that I hung on to on November 24th. I lost every other one out of 42. I suffered a drop for every election, and the reason why has been because people have generally been dropping off on those issues. And finally, in 2007, they thought, this is never going to end unless we change the government. And so they did. I think we would be very naive to think that all we have to do is return to the tried and tested rhetoric of 96, when we said it was only the economy. If the economy heads south, which I think it probably will under this government, sure, the next election will be fought around the economy. But I think Brendan Nelson has done the right thing in reversing our position on Kyoto, on saying sorry, and on work choices, because I think he is listening to the public. And it would be foolish to think that we could continue as we have, because we'd be making the same mistake that unfortunately state oppositions have made since 1999.
Rest, do you want to add to that? Okay, we'll take a final question up here and then we'll finish, because otherwise we'll be here all night. And we may be here or not, depending on the answers. Yes.
Alexander Gates, by name. My question is for Christopher. Christopher, we've seen a lot of discussion tonight about what the Liberal Party should do at a national level. My question is in relation to what the Liberal Party needs to do at the state level. We had speakers talk about their belief in smaller government. How do we reconcile that at a state level, given that at a state level, elections seem to be won or lost on the basis of the party's competency at delivering quality public services, and as someone who's been stuck on a Sydney train and delayed for a long time going home from work, how do we reconcile a philosophical belief in small government with a reputation for managerial competency and new ideas in delivering quality public services?
Now, Christopher's question was directed to Christopher Pine, but if either Kevin or Maurice want to say something, that will be the final comment. So we'll start off with Christopher Pine.
Well, Alexander, thank you for the question. Look, right now I'm more concerned about how the federal Liberal Party is going to revive and win in 3 years' time, or what might well be 2 years' time. So while I've thought long and hard about state oppositions and how to get back into government, right now my focus is on the federal scene, because I am passionate about winning in 2010, and having been a Member of Parliament for 15 years and in the Liberal Party since I was 17, I can tell you that I think this is a do-or-die time for Liberals across the country. But with oppositions, just briefly, there is nothing that is contra-intuitive to a belief in small government and good public services being delivered efficiently and at low cost. The Kennett government, for example, both balanced the books, created a surplus and delivered services to the public. The reason why we're losing at state opposition levels is not because of a failure to understand the issues that the public are interested in, but because we haven't, I think, united in a way that we should have at the state level and fought campaigns based around the future. We've been focusing far too much on the past. One of the beauties of my idea of allowing the party membership to vote in leadership elections is that in Canada and other jurisdictions, it's led to a massive influx of new members. And at every state, in every state division, and New South Wales is no different. In fact, some would say it was rather a good example. We need a huge influx of new members to support the members that are there now and to dilute the rotten boroughs that eventually form when the pool of people who are responsible for making decisions becomes smaller and smaller. It is, I think, unfortunate that the New South Wales division of the Liberal Party has less members than the Victorian division of the Liberal Party with a much greater population. I'm not saying the Victorian division has got it right in terms of membership, because they have a low membership in comparison to the history of that division. But the state oppositions are now, I think, focusing on what they believe in. In South Australia, Martin Hamilton Smith is making real inroads on the Rand government by setting the agenda. Unfortunately, it took, in every case, at least one election drubbing after an initial defeat for the state oppositions to realise that there were no more Western Australian inks, state banks, New South Wales corruption issues, tri-continental or tri-continental collapses in Victoria. There was no magic bullet. That actually you had to believe in things, and if you put what you believe into the public in an articulate way as a united team, you are going to be rewarded for doing so. And oppositions around the country are now finally, I think, starting to do that.
Kevin Andrews?
My observation of state oppositions is that they need to concentrate on the basics. What do people want from a state government? Essentially, they want to be able to walk around their streets in safety. They want to know that their kids are going to be well educated. They want to know that if you take your wife to a major public hospital in Sydney and she's pregnant, she's going to end up being properly cared for and not left in some room for hours or on a trolley. They want a transport system that operates effectively so you can get to work and equally importantly, get home from work in a timely manner. I think these are the things essentially, and there's others, these are the things which states are basically doing. They're providing services, and it's a question of quite clearly identifying where current state governments are failing in their task, and they are right around Australia, but also, secondly, articulating in a unified way policies that will actually address those issues. See, I believe in order for a change of government to occur, two preconditions have to be present. One is that there is a sense of frustration with the existing government. It's on the nose, it's incompetent, it's corrupt, whatever, or it's been there too long perhaps even. But secondly, that there is a credible opposition. And I think we've seen around Australia, tragically, cases where people have been had an inclination to change a government because they weren't happy with the one in existence, but didn't think that the alternative was credible enough to vote for. And I think that's where the work has to be done.
Thanks, Jared. Let me just say something about opposition to start with. I'm not going to give Barry O'Farrelly any gratuitous advice. I'm sure he wouldn't welcome it for starters. But until the 25th of November, there are a lot of people in my party room who had absolutely no idea what the penury of opposition is like. None. There may be some who still haven't determined exactly how difficult it is going to be. So what we need to think about is what we expect of our state oppositions, in this case, all our colour, in contrast to what government can do. Someone said to me the other day that the turnover of staff in the physical building that is Parliament House in Canberra in a sitting week was 500 of us out, 500 of them in. 500 new Labor staffers, give or take. And so, as I had mentioned during the last few years of our government, if we expected our state oppositions to perform at a particular level and had a range of expectations of them in terms of policy development, their capacity to present policy, to argue the case, to get the media, to get the financial support, and so on, then it was indeed incumbent upon us to share some of our expertise, particularly as members and senators, of having had the opportunity to enjoy a fairly reasonable period of government for some extended period of time. And I think some of the ministers, as individuals, took that up as both an opportunity and a challenge. But some probably did not. And so their poor benighted shadows in oppositions around Australia, in the Northern Territory, in Victoria, in New South Wales, in Western Australia, were left, as we now are, the ultimate irony, struggling to work it all out for ourselves in the face of 500 new staffers on the other side. It's a very significant task. I think the media underestimate it. I think corporate Australia underestimates it in terms of how much they're prepared to help the people they support, how much they'll actually ante up in terms of intellectual engagement and support, in terms of money. It's all very well to complain about the challenges of making regular financial contributions to an opposition team when they're your team. Well, don't complain the day after if you're not prepared to stump up in the first place. And I think the challenges of actually being in opposition in nine jurisdictions in this country are seriously underestimated by many people on the sidelines.
Well, we could go on all evening, but we don't, and it's nearly 7 o'clock, so I'd just like to be very brief, and I wasn't sure what to expect tonight, but we've had 3 very thoughtful papers and consequently challenging papers, which will be good to publish and will be discussed for some time. So I'd like to thank Senator Payne and Mr. Andrews and Mr. Pine for a very lively night at the Sydney Institute, which I'm sure will live on for some time. So thanks to all of you. Well done.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. And I'm sure we'll have our speakers back at the Institute again sometime in the future.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.